You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to episode 36 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Connect with us on Twitter at SM&P Podcast, or check out the Facebook page, Social Media and Politics Podcast. As ever, thank you so much for tuning in to the show. This episode, we're going to be talking about cloaked Facebook pages, which is essentially when someone creates a Facebook account under a false identity to spread propaganda. Clearly, fake news has been in the media a lot recently, but the notion of someone actually creating a false identity on Facebook to spread propaganda is something that hasn't been touched on so much. But Johan Farkas and his colleagues at the IT University of Copenhagen have been looking into exactly this. And more specifically, they've been looking at public Facebook pages that have been created by anonymous users or perhaps organizations that brand themselves as Muslim public figures and then spew out propaganda that plays into some rather unfortunate stereotypes about Muslims in Denmark. So to give you an idea of the kind of content that they're spreading, and I'm not going to read all of it because I don't want the explicit button on iTunes, but for example, Allah Akbar, you should, by the way, know that I take your money, I have sex with your cheap women, and I make them pregnant, which plays, again, to these kind of stereotypes about migrants or refugees in Europe. But we know that these are fake accounts because they go in and they moderate specifically instances where these accounts are called out for being non-authentic. So I have Johan here in studio, and I'm going to bring him on in a moment, and we're going to dig into the dynamics of exactly how this is going down, but also how citizens have actually created a Facebook group to collectively report these accounts and what Facebook's response has been to these reports. And we've actually live streamed this episode, so if you go on our Facebook page, you can kind of check out and see what the behind the scenes looks like. And it's a little bit rough on the edges, but it's kind of a first foray into the live streaming. But whenever I get a chance, I will be more active in that and putting it up on Facebook and also on YouTube. And one last thing before we jump into that interview, which is I want to say thanks for all who took the Twitter poll recently about what I should do for a new episode. And overwhelmingly, the responses were about the dark web. And your voice has been heard. And our next episode, which I will release just before Halloween, is going to be on social networks on the dark web with an anonymous web blogger named Syphus, who goes around and trolls the dark web for different social platforms and writes up reviews about them. So that's super interesting. I have no idea what to expect from it, but that will drop on October 29th, just before Halloween, and I may go ahead and throw in some spooky sound effects as well. But for now, let me turn it over to my guest today, who is Johan Farkas. He's a lecturer and researcher at the IT University of Copenhagen. You can follow him on Twitter at JD Farkas. Johan, thanks so much for taking the time out. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
I'm glad to be here.
So we've all been hearing about dark ads on social media recently, and you've been focusing on something that's similar yet different but equally as dark, and that's cloaked Facebook pages. So can you start out by explaining exactly what a cloaked Facebook page is?
Yes, so cloaked Facebook pages is a form of identity-based deception. And what I've been studying in a Danish context is a number of Facebook pages that sparked widespread attention on social media, where anonymous administrators created a lot of Facebook pages, or I ended up studying 11 I was able to identify as cloaked, because as we can get back to, this is kind of a tricky one. But these 11 Facebook pages sparked over 20,000 comments from Danish Facebook users, and they claimed that they were Muslims living in Denmark, and they used stolen profile photos and made up names, and then wrote that Muslims in Denmark have this conspiracy to kill and rape kill and rape Danes and take over society. And this sparked uproar, you could say. And unfortunately, most of the people who reacted were not able to identify that these pages were cloaked, and reacted with both aggression towards the pages, but also hatred towards Muslims in Denmark.
And when you say that they had stolen pictures, what kind of pictures did they have?
So they claimed to be individual Muslims living in Denmark, and these made up names. I mean, it, for instance, identifying that it is made up is difficult when you just follow one page. So it was only by following several pages over time, over 6 months, that I was able to establish this. So, for instance, they would use the name Mohammed El Sayed on one page, and then on the next page, they would be Fatima El Mohammed, and there would be Sarah El Sayed, kind of just playing around with the same few names and creating these identities. But the key point with these pages was that they did not just write that they wanted to kill Danes or whatever. They wrote that there was kind of this widespread conspiracy. So it kind of talked into perhaps a conspiracy theory that some already believe in Denmark about foreigners and in this case a Muslim minority in Denmark, that they have some kind of conspiracy, right? And played into a fear that exists, and that made it go viral,
like kind of playing on different stereotypes.
Yeah, so this is very much what we've called it in a forthcoming article. Me and my colleagues, we have called it the enactment of an antagonized other. So, I mean, this stereotype of Muslims in this case is a stereotype that is found quite consistently kind of within far-right discourse and extreme-right narratives. So these pages kind of took that narrative and enacted it as kind of making it real in some strange sense.
And were they public pages, or were they private accounts, or?
So these were created as pages, and on Facebook all pages are public, and they you can choose different categories, and they chose kind of the public figure category. So this is, of course, it could just as well have been profiles. We've seen, especially on Twitter, that the use of fake accounts there to spread different political discourses, that practice is quite widespread. So I mean, the idea of cloaked identities for political propaganda, disguised political propaganda, that is kind of, it could be from a profile, it could be from a page. In our case, this was Facebook pages.
And that's interesting, because if you are a public page, then you're opened up to a whole range of the advertising tools, right? You can boost posts, you can, for example, run an ad campaign. But that's outside what an actual individual profile can do, right? So did they use any of these kind of functions of the public page that you could identify?
I mean, one of the things that is so difficult on social media is to determine who creates content, especially in these cases of disguised propaganda. So in propaganda studies, I've used these two concepts from Jacques Ellul, who was a very influential book on propaganda in the 60s, who separated between vertical and horizontal propaganda, which basically means vertical is propaganda deriving from an organized, large-scale organization of some kind, and then we have kind of horizontal propaganda deriving from within a crowd in some sense. What we can in this case, for instance, I have a hypothesis that this is horizontal propaganda, but I actually don't know, right? So I can't. That is just kind of there are indications, but I don't have any kind of way of arriving at a positive conclusion on this. So, for instance, did they use ads? We didn't find this, but I mean, they could have in theory. But what we can see here is that they used a lot of the functionalities of pages in a quite sophisticated and also, of course, worrisome way. For instance, the pages can comment on other pages. So a way that would attract attention was to go in on Danish news media outlets on their Facebook pages, and every time there was a story about immigrants, they would take part in that discussion, kind of writing these outrageous things about wanting to kill Danes. And then that attracted attention. On their own page, then, when people commented there, then all the people who wrote, "This is fake," those comments got deleted.
Right.
So what you would have is thousands of comments from people who actually believed in the source, and those hundreds of comments from people who did not, they got deleted, right? So that kind of strengthened the narrative. So I don't think in this case that this could have been done, and I think it was, without any funds at all. Mm. I mean, and this is basically the point, that today disguised propaganda, it can derive. We are definitely seeing also that government agencies in other countries are taking advantage of these kind of tactics, but it's very hard to identify as such. And in this case, for instance, it could just as well have been a single individual doing it, either due to his political orientation, kind of wanting to spread this fear or reinforce this fear towards Muslims in Danish society. But it could also be someone having a strange sense of humor, kind of thinking that this is fun to provoke trolling, of as it's called. So this is a very, very complicated reality we're dealing with here.
Now, I mean, so you mentioned, I think it's interesting that the page, if someone had commented on it questioning the authenticity of the account, that page would then remove the comment, right?
Mm.
So, I mean, how much activity were these pages getting? And can that give us an idea of whether it was one person or a lot? Because if it's tons of activity on the page and it's really heavily curated, then maybe that would signal a network of users versus...
Mm. I mean... Again, if it was someone who spent all his time doing it while these pages were up, I mean, the thing with these pages is that they existed for very short periods of time. And this is, of course, due to Facebook's policies, that Facebook actually quite quickly enforced these policies and deleted the pages.
Mm.
But, I mean, this sounds great, but the problem is that within that time, they can reach so many people. So, for instance, the most viral, you could say, page existed for less than 4 days and got more than 10,000 comments within these days.
Really?
And more than 5,000 shares. So, and this is from Danish Facebook users, right? Because it's all in Danish. And for a country with 5.7 million people, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And yeah, so in this sense, I mean, if a person has the time and spends those 4 days basically all the time pretty much on his Facebook page and curates it in this way and provokes, then it could be one person, I think. But I mean, it's very likely that it was an organized group of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is speculation. And I mean, the important point here, and I think the important point that our research is making, is that we need to study this, although it is very difficult, because we also need to raise awareness towards the effects that this can have. And I mean, no matter who created these pages, if it was as a joke, if it was for highly political reasons, no matter the reason, we can see that it had an effect, in that so many people commented, so many people believed in it. And I mean, the worrisome implication is that these people, who reacted, they never get a notification that this is deleted, right? They will see it, they will get provoked, then it gets deleted shortly thereafter, and then the people behind can just create a new one, right? So this policy of just removing the content, after doing this research, I've also become increasingly actually skeptical towards this approach.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, it is a good idea. It sounds, at least on the surface, as a very good idea to just remove it as fast as possible.
Right.
But on Facebook, we know that Facebook's public relevance algorithms, the way they work is that one of the most important factors is time decay, right?
Mm-hmm.
So new content will always get more attention. I mean, within these 4 days before Facebook deletes it, they can reach these thousands of people. And when Facebook deletes it, then it, of course, can't reach any further. But still, perhaps it wouldn't have reached that many further anyway, because it kind of went viral from the onset. And then that makes it a lot harder for journalists, researchers, law enforcement, who wants to investigate this, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So... most of these pages I've been studying, or we've been studying, me and my colleagues, they existed for a few days. So you really had to be there. And in some cases also, we found pages, of course. We collaborated with different activist groups in order to find these pages. And in several cases. Like, I had received an email from or a message on Facebook from one of these activists stating, now there's a new page, it has already has thousands of comments. And before I saw the message, kind of 1 hour later, it was already gone, right? Mm-hmm. So
that makes data collection pretty tough.
Yeah. So the way we collected this data was basically throughout 6 months, every time we received such a tip, just basically literally throwing everything kind of you are doing and just running to the computer and started taking the screenshots and grabbing the content, because you never knew when they would be gone.
That's interesting. It's an interesting point you raise about the algorithms and time decay, because it made me think of something else, which is also just the level of activity. Mm. And so if these pages emerge and they're posting really, really controversial content that gets a bunch of people to start going crazy in the comment fields with different opinions and going back and forth, that's going to shoot it up in the algorithms. And I mean, obviously, we don't know to what extent the people behind these accounts know what they're doing, but they might be doing this strategically, factoring in the reach of with the algorithms.
Exactly. And I mean, this content is definitely kind of tailored to go viral. I mean, no matter if they are kind of aware of this or not, the people who created it, that on Facebook, another key factor, right, for their algorithm to decide what goes viral, as you say, that is the weight, or the kind of the what is this, how important does the algorithm assess this content to be? Mm-hmm. And one of the key factors in this regard, that is how many people are commenting, how fast. And this is also, of course, on personal profiles. This is on all types of content. So if I write that I've just gotten a new job or something, and that receives a lot of likes from the people who see it as first, then it will go further into my
snowballs.
Network. Yeah, exactly. And of course, shares, when people share content, that is even more powerful. And in these cases, we see a lot of comments, we see a lot of shares. So in that way, it can really reach a lot of people. And even if it wasn't, that's kind of also the point. Even if this case, we've been studying these cases, if they were not aware of this or didn't tailor specifically for this, then there would still be someone else who could do it, right?
Right.
And perhaps do it even more effectively. And now we're back to perhaps the vertical propaganda, that this kind of tactic could very effectively be used by large-scale organizations as well.
Yeah, and on different accounts at once, right?
Tagging. Yeah. And due to the kind of decentralized structure of social media, it becomes very hard to tell when something is created by a government agency or an individual. We've seen this in relation to the US elections as well. There has been some really interesting studies, kind of large-scale quantitative studies, on how many accounts were driven by social bots or were social bots. So a social bot, of course, is a profile, social media profile, not driven by a human, but by algorithms or a software. So some studies estimate that 20% of the content during the elections on Twitter was created by social bots. And that is, of course, a lot. But these studies also kind of, their conclusion section, all of them, is kind of a big disclaimer. We have no idea who did this. We can't really say anything about this. These 20%, that's a lot, but it could be a lot of different individuals using these tactics. Mm-hmm. Setting up accounts, it's not that difficult, and you can find tutorials easy online. So this is a very complicated reality we're dealing with.
And even since, so we had an episode on bots where we were talking about how easy it is to set them up. And you don't even have to do that. You can just buy them on different websites. I mean, you just search buy bots and they're not that expensive. But I wanted to kind of keep on this idea of the algorithms. And I wanted to ask, so what was the time frame that you looked at these pages?
So this was, we did the data collection from spring 2015 and then until early 2016. But in the article we already have out that's on these pages, that was the first 6 months of data collection.
So it's not like it was 2011 when Facebook was completely
No. Structure. I mean, it's before everyone started talking about fake news, but it's quite recent.
Because what I wanted to ask is, in terms of like gaming the algorithms, I mean, another way to do that is by using, for example, pictures or videos or different multimedia. Mm. Was it just text that these guys were posting?
Or? No. They of course appropriated images as well, so kind of just took images from different contexts. Several images were from the protest against the Muhammad drawings, as the so-called Muhammad drawings, which were this satirical drawings in Denmark, right, that sparked uproar in the Middle East, as it was depictions of Muhammad. I think everybody's familiar with this. So. They are from these protests against Denmark in the Middle East. Pictures of burning Danish flags. This kind of content was used, but they also created some of their own content. So the most commented post, actually, that was a screenshot of a video, and also the video where you see a toilet bowl, and then there is a Danish flag in the toilet, and some and a person who you can't see in the picture is pissing down in this toilet bowl, right? And this the screenshot of this received more than 7,000 comments within these 3-4 days, and the video also had several thousands.
It's interesting to me that, I mean, I hear you talking about the Danish flag used in these images, but also the stereotypes that are played on is very Danish focused, and it's interesting that these pages will post so much with a kind of nationalist sentiment or playing on feelings of nationhood that. I think maybe Danes have implicitly, but they're not a like openly patriotic type country like the U.S. But do you have an idea as to why there was so much focus on, you know, not just promoting Islam, but sort of with a real spin to the Danes? Do you see what I mean?
Like, yeah. I think overall, and this is actually also a point I'm taking from Jacques Ellul and his book on propaganda back from the 60s, and it's also a point actually that been raised even before by Becker. But anyway, the point is that in order to create disguised propaganda, because this is of course not a new phenomenon. I mean, the form is new, but we've seen during the Cold War, during the Second World War, radio stations, for instance, created by one side of the war, imitating the other side, trying to come off as deriving from within enemy territory. And these kinds of tactics, the key to these tactics, there are two things. One, you need to be able to know the media channel very well and appropriate it very well. But the other thing is that you really need to have a very good understanding of the culture you're trying to mimic, right? And I think in this case, it could only derive from a Dane. Of course, it's also in Danish, so that says a lot. But I mean, this is very much also plays on discourses within Denmark. So, I mean, this was in 2015. This was the year of the so-called refugee crisis. We had national elections in June 2015. And this is, again, some of the scary implications that we see. Some of the pages that existed just before the election, we see a lot of people writing, now I know what I will be voting. And now I'm definitely sure what I will be voting. And again, like I don't think that that this had any big effect on the elections, right? Most of these people just would probably have voted as they did anyway. But it is kind of still chilling to see that this is how they react. Perhaps it's not something that is created, but it is reinforced and amplified in some way. Kind of this is what we saw the most was the people referring to elections wrote like kind of, now I'm definitely sure why I vote for instance, the Danish People's Party, which is the right-wing nationalist party in Denmark. So it was definitely very much related to the context. And I mean, Denmark as a very homogenous Scandinavian country, I mean, the immigration has just become a huge, huge issue, right? And it's been so for the last 20, 30 years in Denmark. And of course, in times such as the refugee, so-called refugee crisis, this was the number one agenda. So suddenly having these profiles claiming to be Muslims and claiming that there is, in fact, kind of a conspiracy to take over the country, that will touch on some very hot buttons.
Yeah, it's interesting that I kind of forgot about what was going on during that time frame that might drive this activity. So we have a question actually off the live stream.
Wow.
Which is, could you tell something about who comments on these pages? So we don't know who's behind them, but in the comment fields, I guess we can go in and see, you know, we can't assume they're real people either.
Mm.
But have you looked into who's commenting or what they're commenting?
Yeah, I would. I mean, of course, what they're commenting is something we have studied, right? So what we did was to quantify the most used words, to be more specific, the most used kind of adjectives, adverbs, and nouns. And what we find there is, it kind of sums it up quite well. We find fuck, shit. Well, not shit, but fuck. We find, unfortunately, paki, kind of perker in Danish, which is a very offensive racist term. And we find the Danish People's Party as one of the most used terms. Denmark, country, home, because a lot of what they're writing is it's very short comments. That's what most people write, right? And that will basically be go home to your country, this kind of rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
And who are then these people? I mean, this is not something I would very much like to do more on this side of it. Like, how did they discover these pages? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've followed the pages, so I know that they did this thing about commenting on news outlets, Facebook pages. But there are still a lot of questions that I would like to explore. But generally, I would say, I know that's kind of a bit lame thing to say, but I mean that it was average people in some sense. I mean, it was if you click in on these profiles, a lot of them would of course have private accounts, in the sense that I can't see what they post, but they will have images of their kids, and they would be from all over Denmark. I think there was a majority coming from outside of Copenhagen.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is definitely something I want to explore more. Also, kind of, I've been thinking about, it could be very interesting to set up experiments as well, kind of showing different content and also trying to figure out the importance of these comments. Because one thing, again, they deleted all the comments from people who write it's fake.
Mm.
And then what we're left with, that's all the other comments, right? All the aggressive comments. How does that affect other people's perception when they arrive on the pages, right? Does that play a role in enforcing their belief that this is actually true? So this, for instance, could be interesting, right? Setting up an experiment where people see some content and then see some content writing it's fake, and some other it's the same content where people write that it's not fake, kind of believe it. Does that make a difference? These kinds of questions I would very much like to explore.
Yeah, and we had Dr. Scott Wright on the show a couple episodes back, and he works with these online spaces and the political talk that goes on there.
Mm.
And yeah, I think he would say the same thing, which is that the way that the tone is set, especially by people who are very active. Like when you go onto a Facebook page and if you see there's just curse words flying around and it's a very charged political topic, you're going to have a different experience than if it kind of it's in a different context and a different tone. So that's interesting. And I think the implication is that a small number of users, perhaps the page organizers themselves or, you know, individually, they can really set that tone by posting a lot and really kind of setting the norm for what goes on in that page.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a hypothesis I would very much like to test. Of course, they already set the tone by kind of creating these profiles and writing the post themselves, right? Which
True.
Are very, very aggressive. But it would be interesting to kind of figure out if people see comments, if they see comments from others who write this is fake, are they then also less likely to believe the source, or does that have an effect? And I would, of course, the hypothesis would be yes, probably, but I think we would need to do some experiments on this.
Yeah.
That could be very interesting.
Definitely. So we've been looking at the side of these cloaked pages and the propaganda they've been spreading. But then he did a super interesting follow-up study, which is a great take, I think, on the other side, which was a Facebook group called Stop Fake Hate Profiles on Facebook that was used as a way to crowdsource users to combat these accounts. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yes, yeah, so a few months into our study, we got lucky in some sense that because these pages deleted users writing that it was fake, some users wanted to kind of organize the who had encountered these pages didn't fall for the trick, you could say, and they wanted to kind of organize contestation against them. So they created a group on Facebook called Stop Fake Hate Profiles on Facebook. And because I was already doing this study, I of course contacted them, and we exchanged some theories and kind of some data and what had we found so far. But that ended up also being kind of part of the study. Not just it started off kind of as a collaboration to find pages and study them, but I ended up also being very interested in what went on in that group and got permission to do kind of participant observational research within that group. And what they did was to try to organize or kind of crowdsource contestation. So that mainly meant that they used the report button on Facebook to report to Facebook that these pages, when they showed up, that this was fake accounts and they were spreading hatred, right? And Facebook is very, very opaque in this regard. We have no idea kind of how they evaluate. We kind of know that they only evaluate when people report. But if you read their terms of condition, then they say that it doesn't matter how many people report it. But
if you have 2,000 people reporting one account.
According to Facebook, that's what they write, kind of black and white, that has no influence. But what these activists found was that a lot of the time they used the group to kind of speculate about culprits, speculate about how the algorithms work, speculate about how Facebook processes these reports. So what they found, for instance, was that when they discovered a new page, started reporting, Facebook would quite quickly send a report, kind of a reply back, kind of an automated reply, that this does not violate our content, our community standards. And then a few hours or days later, they would kind of reverse that. They would say, suddenly you would get a new automated reply saying, now we've deleted it. And that led them to speculate that, one, that the amount of reports matters a lot, and also that they speculated that Facebook perhaps first algorithmically kind of tries to figure out if they need to remove this and then only later kind of deploys actual fleshy humans to look at the content, right? So and again, it's speculations, but of course I was not trying to figure out what was the truth. I just wanted to figure out how are they trying to kind of negotiate this this very complicated platform. And what I found, and what we're quite critical towards in our paper on this, is that Facebook on the surface says that they want to remove this kind of content and give these tools, but it's very, very opaque. It's very difficult for activists to actually do anything. And the truly worrisome implication, which was also something that caused quite a lot of frustrations in the group, was that every time Facebook deletes it, it has no implications for the people behind, right? They can just create a new one, and they did. So sometimes you would actually have a page is created, it exists for, let's say, a week, attracts a couple of thousand comments, it gets deleted, a new page is created with the exact same name and the same post recreated, and then that gets deleted, and then they do it again. And so kind of this process caused a lot of frustrations. And they wanted to, another thing they wanted was to report it to authorities in Denmark. They tried to file police reports, tried to contact also kind of, the Danish kind of FBI kind of situation, PET. So they tried to do these things, but that didn't result in anything. And I mean, I can understand that as a police officer, for instance, you get a report from someone saying, you should look into this. It was some content that was on Facebook, and it was deleted after 2 days and it's not there anymore, but you really should look into it because it's very important. I mean, there, suddenly, the fact that it's deleted, the fact that Facebook provides unlimited anonymity for the people behind, that just that actually poses a problem in this regard. So I've become more skeptical towards the approach that Facebook has, which is deleted. And then kind of that's it.
Yeah, I have a number of things I want to pick up on there. The first is it goes back to what we were saying before in terms of the time decay, which is if their page is deleted and then they come back with the exact same page, they're counted as a new account. And I think it's safe to say new accounts, when you make your first post, it's likely to go farther than, you know, to kind of incentivize.
Yeah, I mean, again, we quite quickly end up in these speculative discussions. But I mean, that could be the case. And of course, I think if you create six times in a row pages that are deleted, I would also expect that Facebook kind of perhaps it has some kind of implications. Perhaps Facebook would say that, OK, now we delete your personal account as well, or now you are not allowed to create more pages. But I mean, you can easily create a new profile as well, right? And then create a new page. So, I mean, the only way to truly stop this would be to kind of, to involve law enforcement, for instance. In this case, I would definitely expect that this would be illegal according to Danish law, both because they are writing about killing people. That's kind of that's not so nice. And again, they're using these fake accounts, stolen pictures. I mean, I think that could be prosecuted, but it won't be, because it just gets deleted and they can create a new one.
And I mean, keeping on this idea of Facebook accountability. So, I mean, what the sort of question I had was, you know, it brings in interesting questions of, are the algorithms sort of taking over? Are the algorithms working faster than Facebook can keep up with them? And that's just an open question I have in my head at the moment. But getting to more hardcore stuff, you mentioned in the article that Facebook actively tries, or your opinion was that Facebook actively tries to legally and communicatively distance itself from the abusive material. So in a sense, I think it goes to what you were saying. If the material that could be reported to law enforcement is deleted, then Facebook can kind of say, well, it's not there anymore, we're not accountable. But can you go into what you mean about how the legal structures and how they phrase their community standards tries to make them less accountable?
So, I mean, it's both kind of their practices on Facebook, just deleting the content, right, and then moving on. I think that is problematic. But there's also the whole kind of discursive construction of how they see themselves. So they've repeatedly said that they are not a media company, they're a tech company, right, that they provide a platform, and there will be Zuckerberg has several times said kind of there are several sides, and we get all kinds of political content, and we just want people to be able to share, and again, putting the responsibility on the users. So if there is something that violates, you can just report it to us, and we will kind of we will look into that. And I think it's not that I expect Facebook to go through all the content that's created, right? I mean, that's just not feasible in any way. So, I mean, it's not that it's wrong to put that responsibility on the user. The problem is that they put the responsibility on the user and then gives the user very, very limited options. And kind of it becomes very opaque for users. Kind of they can report it, but what does... When Facebook deletes it, is that because something I did, or was it something else? Or kind of they don't really provide tools or transparency for these kind of citizens who actually do a very good job at kind of trying to help Facebook with this.
Yeah, so kind of be moderators on the helpful moderators on the platform.
Yeah. And for instance, with these pages, it's not just the algorithms, for instance, that enhance this problem. It's also just the interface, kind of this. The pages, of course, are set up for companies mainly, right? This is a commercial platform, so you can do ads. You can delete any content you want. And I think this is just also outside of cloaked Facebook pages, this is kind of raises some issues. Political parties, for instance, on Facebook, if as a political discussion increasingly moves to social media, do we want that everything can just be removed? Again, in Denmark, I don't expect that politicians would remove all criticism on their Facebook page, but I could imagine that happening somewhere else, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there are some issues here around Facebook being built for private individuals and then also built for companies because that's their revenue model. The companies have to be there because they have to deliver the ads. And political discussion has kind of is there, of course, and it's very, very important, but it hasn't really been tailored for that, I would say. And I think there needs to become more transparent, for instance, for activists trying to stop, the hatred in general, but also more specifically phenomena such as cloaked Facebook pages.
And so for this group of activists that were working to alert Facebook to these pages, were they, I mean, I assume that they were led by some real activists who were concerned, but did they enlist the support of just members of the general public to do this? Like, who was the profile of the people who were helping to report the accounts?
So the guy who created the group, he's of course also Danish, and he is not a very politically active person. He's a pilot for, if I remember correctly, Norwegian. It's not that he is very politically engaged otherwise. I think he had just come across these pages and kind of. He was frustrated, as a lot of people were, kind of me myself included, about this phenomenon, and then also got more frustrated as he tried to report it and got this kind of auto reply from Facebook: "No, this doesn't violate our community standards." And also seeing that his own comments when he wrote "this is fake" got deleted. Wow. So he created this group, and it quite quickly gained some traction because one of the tactics they used was to, when a new page came up, they would a lot of people would go in and post links to that group as well, writing that it's fake. And these posts got deleted, right? These comments got deleted, as I've mentioned before, but still kind of with, there were perhaps sometimes an hour or something where these comments would be up. And that kind of gained more members. So, within a quite limited time, they had more than 2,000 members. I think they are past 2,500 now. And that is, I don't think this is not a very political group, and political discussions are not allowed actually in this group. So you're not allowed to kind of discuss politics. It's just about finding pages with disguised authorship and that are spreading hatred. That's kind of their goal. And every time someone comes across that, they will share it within. And then people will go into that page, report it, write comments that this is fake, report back to the group kind of saying, "I just reported, I just commented," and also kind of share information on, "Wow, now I just got this standard reply from Facebook that it doesn't violate the community standards. Did you guys also get that?" These kinds of questions, that was what they were doing. And also some of them started at some time speculating about culprits, kind of who is behind, and kind of trying to come up with, I would say also problematic ideas about who it could be based on some vague assumptions. And that was also kind of not allowed, or like there was also some self-policing in that way that kind of, that was not really, then other users within the group would say kind of, "This is not, we are not a vigilante group." That was kind of, what we were trying to do is to stop the pages, and we're trying to get in contact with authorities. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that the last part, kind of the contact with authorities, never really
materialized.
They never really got any results.
Yeah, it makes me think, and I know this is a tough question, but about what type of steps could be taken to maybe increase the accountability of Facebook. And one of the things I think about is the up and down vote feature as a way to kind of crowdsource or outsource the content that flows on the platform. Because if everyone would just downvote the posts of these accounts, they would, maybe that would be a better way to signal. But then, of course, it could also be manipulated. So one feature I thought that could be a better way would be up and down voting. But I mean, do you have any idea or concrete steps to take? I know it's very speculative, but
I think the main problem again is that Facebook is just focused on getting the content removed. So, for instance, I think Facebook should collaborate more with authorities in a country like Denmark. So, so if content not just violates Facebook's terms, but if this is something that is actually possibly illegal, kind of writing that you want to kill someone or sharing child pornography or whatever. I mean, in relation to the latter, child pornography, for instance, of course, that's not really shared that much on Facebook. But I know that authorities also collaborate with Facebook, right? And I think it's just not been taken very seriously, this kind of thing that someone somewhere creates a page and then it's deleted after a few days. But I actually think this has worrisome implications. I'm not saying that this is the biggest issue in today's political sphere or in our democracy, but I think it is a somewhat small. That's important for me to stress. I'm not saying at all that this is incredibly widespread or kind of affected any election. I'm just saying that still it represents a problem, and I don't think the solution of just deleting it is viable.
Mm. It may be a small number of people or may have a small reach on Facebook, but it does, I think, speak to the larger issue that is very controversial at the moment, which has been framed as fake news or the post-truth era. And we've been emailing back and forth a bit about this, where you kind of take issue with the post-truth or post-factual era and instead think of it as hyper-factual. So you want to go into that argument?
Yeah. So, of course, when I did this study, that was before fake news was a topic at all, and it's quite interesting. Actually, I can recommend that, kind of go on Google Trends and search for fake news, kind of see the development. And it's in late November, December 2016. It just goes from basically no one Googling it to everyone Googling it, or kind of that's of course a bit it really erupted and it really exploded. And I think there are several problems with the fake news debate, and I'm actually doing work on this as well currently, kind of, which is not more kind of conceptual work or more kind of theoretical work on this issue. And I think the problem with the term fake news, first of all, is that it is built on kind of a quite naive idea about what politics is. So, I mean, it was a term that was originally, it's not that far ago, but when it erupted, it was used in a quite specific way, right? So we had some news websites or what looked at news websites, and they were only spreading fake stories. And the reason they did it was that it could attract clicks, which could give ad revenue. I think there it kind of made sense, but very, very quickly, and the way it's used today, it has just become I argue that it's become a political concept that has very little to do with the amount of false information out there. So, of course, Trump is the key example here. You just calling mainstream media fake news, and they also call him fake news in some sense, right? And I mean, what do we mean by fake? I mean, for instance, Trump is I will take Trump's position here, for instance, that I must only admit this is not that I'm pro Trump, but in, for instance, media outlets said he could not win the election. I mean, that was what the experts said, right? That was what the poll showed, but he won. Is that then fake news? I mean, it was wrong. What do we mean with fake? And I think it builds on a fundamentally, again, naive idea about what politics is. And I think it's even more outspoken with the terms post-truth and post-factual, which I'm very skeptical towards because, first of all, it kind of glorifies the past. Like, if this is the post-truth era, please tell me about the truth era. That must have been great. I mean, was that the second Iraq war? Was it the Cold War? Was it the Second World War? Kind of, when was this truth era?
Yeah.
And even if we say, okay, it wasn't an era, the truth era, but it was an ideal, I would actually still say that I don't think I would want to live in the truth era. To me, kind of in China or in Russia, then if you speak against the truths of the government, that can get you in jail, right? I mean, a fundamental part of democracy is that opposition is allowed. And this is, of course, I'm quite inspired by political theorist Chantal Mouffe and Ernesto Laclau in this regard, who kind of, like, they don't talk about fake news, of course, but their argument is that the idea that democracy is about finding a consensus, that is kind of a flawed assumption in some way, because democracy is about mitigating between opposing groups, and it's not about finding the truth. I mean, a lot of politics is not, of course, there can be misinformation, but most of the time it's not about finding the right or wrong answer. It's about kind of figuring out which of these conflicting groups will get to impose their worldview. So this is why I kind of, in a forthcoming article I'm writing with my colleague Yannick Skov, we argue that we are perhaps more, it's in the hyperfactual era, in the sense that post-factual, it kind of insinuates that facts don't matter anymore. They don't matter. But that's kind of the interesting thing. We've never talked about what is factual and not as much as now. I mean, it has become the key concept in contemporary politics. Are you fake? Are you fake? Who is the fakes? Who's the real ones? Mm. And I think actually the idea of going into a truth era after this era, that would be kind of, that would be a scary scenario, because that would mean that one part, let's say Trump, got to impose his worldview as the truth, the general truth in our societies, right? So if one part won in that sense and got to define what is true, then that would not, that would be, I mean, it's of course speculations, but I don't think that would be very good for democracy. I think democracy is about, again, mitigating between conflicting groups. And so, even though I'm studying manipulation online, I'm studying disguised propaganda, and I think there needs to be more research on this. There needs to be attention towards this, in the sense that Facebook needs to know more about this, law enforcement needs to know more about this, and the general public needs to know more about this. But I don't think that fake news is the biggest issue. And the studies that have come out after the 2016 elections in the US also show that it's very unlikely that fake news in any way could sway the election. So we talk about it a lot, but it's not the biggest issue out there. I think there are a lot of other issues. I mean, no matter if it's disguised or not disguised, we need to teach our kids about racism, no matter if it comes from a disguised source or not. I mean, these are issues that require, I would say, more urgent public attention.
Mm. Yeah, definitely a interesting take on fake news, and I think we'll just let that go ahead and sit with the listeners.
I mean, this is something I'm still developing, this argument. So this is also something now we are live streaming as well. I mean, if there are some comments on this perspective, I would love that, because, or somebody willing to discuss it more than I'm already doing, because I mean this is something I'm still developing, and I know it is. Of course, it's of course not as black as white as I portrayed here, perhaps. But I think there are some fundamental problems about these concepts, especially post-factuality or post-truth, for the reasons I mentioned.
Yeah, it's super interesting. My head is starting to spin. So I think let's leave it there. But Johan, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been
Thank
great.
You for having me.
I've just been speaking with Johan Farkas, lecturer and researcher at the IT University of Copenhagen. Remember that you can follow him on Twitter at JDFarkas, and you can also follow us at SMNP Podcast. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in, and be sure not to miss our next episode, which will be with
Science from the Dark Web.
How cool was that? All right, y'all. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you to Copenhagen University for the studio. Thanks to Earfunk for the jams. I'm your host, Michael Pesetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.